Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Greetings and welcome to this iCoder podcast. I'm Ian McDuff, your host for the series, and I'm speaking with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And in this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague and good friend and fellow member of the global ODR community, Professor Amy Schmitz. Hello, Amy.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Now, Amy, I'm hoping I'm going to get the pronunciation correct here. You are the John Deva Drinko Baker and Hostetler Chair in Law, correct, I hope, at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, which I think is a recent appointment just in the last year, since 2021, I think. Is that right?
Yes, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And from 2016 to 2021, Amy was the Elwood L. Thomas Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the University of Missouri and at the Center for Dispute Resolution. And prior to that, in your peripatetic academic life, at the University of Colorado School of Law for over 16 years. Also practiced law for large firms in Seattle and Minneapolis and served as a law clerk at the United States Court of Appeals on the Eighth Circuit. Amy, your teaching basically covers the law school curriculum, as far as I can tell, with teaching contracts, lawyering, online dispute resolution, artificial intelligence, data analytics and the law, arbitration, international arbitration, consumer law. Is there anyone else at the faculty teaching there? Or is it just you?
Some days it feels like that, to be honest, but hey.
Yeah, well, they're lucky to have you heavily involved in ODR teaching and research for some time, which is how we encounter each other. And you're a fellow of the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution and co-chair of the ABA Technology Committee on dispute resolution, the dispute resolution section, and the ODR task force. I don't think you have a time for a private life, as far as I can tell. You are hosting the arbitration conversation, and to people hearing this podcast, I really strongly recommend going over to that website, the arbitration conversation. There's some really superb resources there. And you're up over 100 episodes, I think. Researcher with the Cyber Justice Lab in Montreal, or Cyber Justice, heavily published, a number of articles in law journals, and co-author of the main textbook, Resolving Disputes, Theory, Practice and Law, which came out in 2021. There's a new book coming out with Tom Stepanovich on arbitration, theory, practice and law, and the book which I'm familiar with, the one you co-author with our good pal Colin Rule, The New Handshake, Online Dispute Resolution and the Future of Consumer Protection. If we have time, Amy, I'd like to come back to The New Handshake and that concept. But for the moment, thank you for joining us in this conversation. It's just great to hear you. I can see you, but others listening to this won't have that benefit. So welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you. No, it's so great. Yeah, like we were talking about, it's so nice to see friends and have our ODR friends, as it were, throughout the world, and having these opportunities on Zoom and on a podcast is really great. And thank you for doing this series. Really, I honestly think this is a huge contribution to the field. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, I have to say I'm loving it. It's great. And for me, down in the bottom corner of the world, it's just a great way of keeping in contact with all these great colleagues. Look at your key research areas at the moment, Amy. There's one that I'd like to ask you to address first of all, because I think it's going to be an issue for most jurisdictions, is the issue of self-represented individuals, self-represented litigants. I know that here at all levels of our court system, they are an issue. In some cases, they drive the judges nuts because they, you know, these people who come for good reason without representation, because representation is hard to come by. And what you're working on, if you could say something about this project on intelligent legal tech to empower self-represented litigants and access to justice. How does this work?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I mean, the truth is, when I went to law school, I always international human rights, right? That was always my goal. That was always at the heart of what I wanted to do. And as I went along and started to learn more, I realized internationally and throughout the world and in so many ways, we don't have access to voice, access to remedies, access to justice, whatever we want to call our justice, but problem solving even, and just having access or to know where to go or what to do is a struggle for many individuals. And what happens is many years ago, eons ago, when I was at University of Colorado, I did an empirical study. And in my empirical study, I did qualitative and quantitative, and I really did a deep dive into consumers' access to remedies. And what I really learned was exactly what I already knew, which was the fact that most consumers don't even complain, don't even do anything because they don't know where to go, and it's not worth the cost to try to litigate. Mm-hmm. And it's not even worth the cost to try to mediate in a lot of cases, and especially not if it's going to be in person. Moreover, and I'd say even more clearly, people do not know their rights. I don't know my rights half the time, right? It's so hard to navigate in this world to just know what your rights are, to know where to turn. And so then you give up and you don't do anything, and you end up, the justice gap gets wider and wider and wider. And so this project, you know, really thinking through with John Zalesnikow from Australia, who's our friend. And so I really wanted to understand from the technologist point of view, what are some of the ideas that we might come up with? And so what we proposed is really a modular system. In the article that I've published recently with the Columbia, it's the Columbia Journal of Law and Technology or something like that, or Science and Technology or something like that, Law Review, and with Columbia Law School in New York, US. And the article puts forth this proposal of a modular approach, thinking about different sort of like Legos, right? Like Legos that could fit together for each individual, depending on what your problem is. So you really are trying to fit the tech to the fuss. You know, we talk in ADR about fitting the forum to the fuss. This would really be about fitting the tech to the fuss. So for example, if let's say I am a individual and I am in fear, which is happening all over the US, of being evicted because I can't afford to pay my rent. And I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. I don't have representation. I can't afford a lawyer. Legal aid is booked up. I can't get a legal aid lawyer to save my life. What am I going to do? So things like providing wizards, online wizards, or solution explorers, whatever you want to call it, that help an individual know just through a simple, it's really not that hard. This technology has been out there for many, many years. You can actually create decision tree analysis that allows that individual to know, oh, here's where you might be able to go to get funding. Here's a housing organization that provides temporary money to pay for rent. Here, you know, give you options, let you know where to go. Also could ask a series of questions to let you know whether you actually might have means or ability to go to legal aid or to go to some particular body in order to get an actual remedy. You might even have possible free mediation services, you know, finding out what your options are. So solution explorers. Another piece is to look at agreement technologies that help you to create a contract without actually hiring a lawyer, right? Also, we have, of course, case management and communication tools, which is what we talk about most often in the ODR world. But what I argue for is supplementing, right? And thinking about different ways that we can use technology to not only sort of resolve disputes as they happen, but to prevent disputes as well, and to help people to know their rights, know where to go, know what the options are. I think that would be very helpful for many self-represented litigants. And to your comment that you made earlier, I really appreciate that about, you know, driving the judges crazy. And you're right. One of the biggest problems my research and has really kind of solidified, self-represented litigants often end up just going home because they make mistakes.
Yep.
The documents are, there's errors in the documents. There's problems that occur where things get dismissed and it might not be right that it was dismissed. It might be a simple error that could have been fixed. We have technologies, agreement technologies that can help those self-represented litigants to avoid errors. You can use, again, decision tree or solution explorers to help you sort of fill in the contracts in the right way by asking the simple questions. There's also use of AI in order to sort of check the documents for errors. And there's a lot of growth in this field using sort of the same ideas that we see with natural language processing and sort of taking large amounts of data. Same thing you can do in terms of court documents, where you are able to use different technologies that can identify errors. So you could help an individual to find those errors and to correct the errors in order to put forth their case.
Two issues about that, at least. I mean, this is so rich. I mean, this could be our one topic for the whole conversation. I'm intrigued by the technology that you that you're using, the steps that you're using. But one question, which probably is as pertinent where you are as it is here, which is for those people who don't have access to the legal solutions, they probably don't also have access to the technology.
Right.
So how do you feed that in?
Right. No, this is where I think, well, first of all, I've argued for this with COVID. It really shined a bright light. And I really, this resonates with me because I am from Wisconsin, middle of nowhere, rural areas where a lot of people don't have technology. And during COVID, especially, you know, you had children who couldn't access class because they don't have the right type of technology in their home and they don't feel comfortable with it. There's also the question of building trust. If you're not someone who's used technology before, why would you use it now? This is where I think we have movements for kiosks, even what they call a justice bus. Yep. And there was just an article out yesterday that I found incredibly intriguing. In fact, I wrote, which I normally don't do, but I wrote the journalist. And I said, I really like, this is something I've been arguing for because I've been arguing for this idea of having what I call kiosks and helpers, meaning this is where in the courthouse, in the libraries, in the senior center, in the schools, you actually have computer kiosks. You have kiosks for people available, but you have a helper, a live person who can help them work through and use the process. And this really isn't a new idea. They already have things like that in public libraries in the US in terms of having kiosks and helpers for other things like building a resume. So why not have it for obtaining remedies and helping individuals through the process? You know, I mean, at a lot of law schools too, we have legal clinics. You know, we could build in these kiosks in legal clinics with helpers who are law students. I just think, you know, these aren't easy answers, I agree, but I think there is movement for change. We have to sort of reimagine and reinvent the way that we think about our courts. You know, a court, I know, our friend Suskin has said this before as well, you know, courts, is it a place or is it a service? And I think when we really think about the goals we're trying to reach through the court in terms of providing justice and providing access to remedies, we need to be more creative, you know, and we might make mistakes, but we have to be willing to fail forward and try new things we haven't done before. So they were even talking about, like I said, justice buses. And really it was, the idea is in rural areas where people don't have the same access to technology for these online courts, that you would bring justice to the people. And you would have these courts that actually, I mean, buses that actually have the technology. You can provide free tablets for individuals to use in order to go through the process. These are ideas that are worthy of exploration because the justice gap is big. And at least here, you know, homelessness has become a real problem, you know, in finding housing and housing issues. And that's just one area. But there's so many other areas that I think are ripe for exploration that it's worth a try.
I'm going to have to, on that, I mean, the justice bus thing, I'm simply going to have to explore that, you know, once we've had this conversation. But a shout out to a similar idea from a colleague of mine you may know, mediator in Scotland, John Sturrock, who was really the founding person behind the Green Pledge Initiative for Mediators, which is now, I think we've got well over 600 signatures to that. But several years ago, when there was public contention in the north of Scotland about a new proposed highway, well, using existing roads, it's called the Northern 500, it's a beautiful tourist route around the north of Scotland. He and a couple of colleagues embarked on what they called the Better Conversations Bus. And basically he and a couple of colleagues and a bus driver on the bus toured the Northern 500 to stop in little villages to ask people, had they been listened to, had they been heard, had their conversations been heard. And basically the message was they hadn't been.
Yeah.
But the idea, yes. And this goes so much to the heart of what you mentioned before, you know, the 1975 idea of fitting the forum to the fuss. Now, actually, well, fitting the forum to the bus. Actually, going where the disputants are. And these days, with the online world, the disputants are out there. They're not mm-hmm. at some center. And also, if you pick up, when you picked up on Richard Susskind's point about whether the court is a place or a service, this is actually less and less about court, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
As
mm-hmm.
self-represented litigants. Forget the idea of litigants, they're not going to go to court. They can't.
No.
It's access, and the terminology you've used, and we've since Mauro Capelletti's book, you know, in the 70s, how do you have access to resolution, and resolution mm-hmm. as justice?
That, yeah.
And also, I've asked this of one of my earlier conversational colleagues. Have you seen the film I, Daniel Blake?
Oh, it sounds so familiar.
If you can find it, it's like one of those gritty Northern English films about an unemployed man who was entitled to a whole lot of benefits, but of course he didn't have access to those benefits because he didn't have access to the technology, which would allow him. And so he went to a library, which is your point about there being kiosks and libraries. But of course he was confronted with a computer he'd never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
They had no mm-hmm. idea how to use. So, you know, what you're suggesting is while you're building the technology solutions to access, you also need to build the solutions to the technology.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate. So I, again, you know, my parents, my mom especially doesn't really like using computers or things like that. And so I did, and this is before COVID, I did a research with a colleague in New Hampshire, and we called it Ask Your Mom. And the idea was built around thinking about my mom. And if I'm building a system, I need to ask my mom. And the idea was, you need to build systems thinking about the people that wouldn't normally feel comfortable. How could you help individuals feel comfortable? And the idea of live helpers really makes a difference. Mm-hmm. In our survey, in our research, we found that many individuals who wouldn't normally ever try it will try it if there is a live helper.
Live, this, as in someone, a physical human being, not someone on the screen.
Physical human available.
Right there with you. Yeah,
available.
Absolutely.
And you don't need them after the first time. It's like training mm-hmm. wheels on a bike, right? Once you try the bike with the training wheels, before you know it, you're able to ride a bike without the training wheels. So having someone available in the beginning to get people started is actually very beneficial for the long run and for the long term.
Mm. Except that, man, you and I are probably quite heavily involved in technology as much as many people. But, you know, when things don't work, even for us,
mm-hmm.
don't you feel terribly alone? Because there's mm-hmm. nobody you can call. And so for those of us who are reasonably familiar with this stuff, you're still going to feel awfully alone. So the idea of there being physical resources, people still need a place to go, don't they? If you know you can toddle down to your, well, here in New Zealand, it would be the Citizens Advice Bureau or some sort of storefront law shop, because you're never, never going to walk into one of the glossy Main Street law firms. But you need to go to the library, to go to a kiosk. Michael Fang, our colleague, has talked about the kiosks that are available in the courts in China, where you can literally ask the robot a question, voice activated, and it will give you the answers. This is both really sort of big stuff, Amy, but it's also a little bit scary, isn't it? But what's more scary is the tens of thousands of people who don't have access to the kinds of solutions that you and I and our colleagues might have. And these are problems which often arise online, but the example you started with, which is so perfect, which is here also a case in New Zealand and no doubt globally, of people in current economic circumstances risking losing their homes or their right to occupy a home. Where is this experiment up to? Are you at the stage of implementing anything, or is this setting out the parameters?
So the proposal was to sort of spark ideas and set you know, options and get people started. But I will say, so the National Center for State Courts here in the United States, and this is before COVID, we had a round table and they were talking about ideas like chatbots, like you were saying, frequently asked questions where you have robots essentially answering questions for people. And solution explorers and the idea of building those into systems, there's actually quite an appetite for that. I know even with the ODR pilots that are happening in the courts here in Ohio, where I am, they do have different sort of off ramps to legal aid and things like that for individuals, and trying to send them, at least providing kind of doors, right? Right. So if you have a housing issue, oh, you might be able to get funds from COVID relief, like sending people into options. And I think that's a start. I think it's a start to move in that direction. I also think there's companies out there who are starting to do things like using machine learning in order to check documents for errors. That is actually happening already in private industry. And so I'd like to see that make the jump from the private to the public. Of course, money becomes an issue, but there's absolutely an appetite. And as far as innovation, it's out there. I mean, we have the technology is growing and it's becoming better and better. Originally, it wasn't very accurate. In fact, it was funny with the, we did a, there was a demo for one of these courts that was using that natural language processing and chatbots in order to help self-represented litigants like answer questions. And when it first started, it was very bad, right? Because it wasn't properly trained. It's like with Alexa, which is, you know, the device you might have that uses natural. In the beginning, it might be terrible and not learn at all. It doesn't know anything. It gives you the wrong music, plays the wrong podcast, but then
sends you the wrong groceries.
Sends you the wrong groceries. I mean, there's a lot of bad things that can happen there. But I think with time, it learns. It learns. I mean, that's what machine learning is about. And so it gets better. And they found that to be true. To an extent where the machine was actually better than the individual. And that's the goal. You're trying to, you know, can we create a process where the machine is actually more accurate? And let's face it, humans make errors too. So, you know, providing these different opportunities is absolutely, and I think they're going to become more and more and better and better.
Two questions. I mean, and there's so many questions out of this, but one is the proposal that you've put forward, is that likely to be at least in part mobile based or mobile phone based? Because, you know, the folks who don't have access to a laptop or a tablet may have access, or their kids have access to a phone.
It has to be mobile friendly. It has to be, because I had done an article quite a few years ago now, but I'm sure it's still pretty accurate from my research. I always update and I look to see what the research is. And there's no question, mobile access is really vital. We even saw that with COVID. You know, many children were attending school via a mobile device because nobody had a regular computer at their home. I mean, it's really a luxury to have regular internet access and a laptop. That's not normal. I mean, we're getting this sort of, it's a sort of a new type of digital divide too, in terms of what kind of technology you have. So, you know, some people have the whiz bang, you know, they have the ring light and the microphone and five screens and all the rest of it. And then the other person's on a phone. So we need to be
cognizant
of that. And it's a
phone that's four generations out of date.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's not,
And hasn't been updated. Yeah. When I think about whiz bang here, I've got this fancy microphone, which Colin insisted I buy, and a phone sitting on my laptop screen. I've got another screen up behind me and another iPad over here. But some of us, and it's actually quite a small percentage, are surrounded by the detritus of our technology world. And some either choose not to, or, you know, is ask your mum idea.
Yeah.
Simply just haven't grown up with that stuff. Mm-hmm. Will probably only have occasional need, but when the need arises, my God, the need is there. And
oh, I know.
You have to have somewhere to go. And what I love about what you're proposing is that it's both complex in that the technology is very rich, but it has to be as simple as possible. It's not going to scare people away.
Yep, it has to be designed. I mean, that's the other piece that I think is so important for us in legal technology world and the ODR world, is we talk about user-centric design, but we really do need to break down silos and get everyone in the room, you know, to even have people who are user experience where they really are experts in marketing. I mean, that's important too, right? Is yeah. How do you make something so that it is so intuitive and so easy that it really does welcome an individual? And that's hard to do. You know, I mean, Utah faced this. So they had a program that they created, an online dispute resolution program for small claims. Mm-hmm. And really nice, you know, homegrown open source code. They created their own process. The only problem, and now they are going to improve it based on research, but the first go round didn't go very well because, you know, they had a URL that was like super long. So when people got an invitation to join the ODR program, they wouldn't click on it because they thought it was, you know, spam. And it didn't have the right sort of, it wasn't user friendly. People became frustrated. They dropped out. And that became a huge problem, right? And so again, and it, the look of it, just everything was not the right kind of user experience that you would like to have. I mean, the good news is that researchers who were focused on user experience sat there and watched people using the process and saw how frustrated. Yep. And then they did a report and they helped to inform Utah for changes that need to be made. So, I mean, I really do think we have to continually research and revise so that we can reimagine the way that we think about access to justice.
I think I recall reading that report that came out within the last 2 to 3 years, didn't it?
It did. Yep.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And yeah, because we have to be mindful of our assumptions about what is intuitive. I mean, my wife wouldn't appreciate me saying this, but I've said there's always, even though she's a lawyer, I've said there's always a job for her in tech, which is whenever someone says the technology is intuitive, give it to her. And if she can work it, then it's intuitive. And she's using technology all the time. But, you know, right. What some black t-shirted boffin in a dark basement says is intuitive is not. And, the other question that came up when you're talking about the access to the technology, it must be an issue for you in the States as it is here, is language. And if something's voice activated, does it understand somebody who is speaking English as a second or third language? Or is it going to be competent in Spanish or German or any number of the 7,000 languages that are still around? Is there any of that component being fed into the program?
Oh, it's got to be. I mean, I hope for it. Of course, you know, it's not built yet, but this is really important. You know, there was a, in 2020, the ABA, American Bar Association Center for Innovation, did a study. And I have this visual. It's really kind of shocking to me. It was looking at the features of ODR systems, the current ones in the US, and the ability to handle different languages. A very small percentage had that ability, which I thought was really problematic, right? And how do we know that a person, if they get invited to join, if they don't feel comfortable with the language aspect, they have to proactively opt out for some of these? Well, what if they don't even know how to proactively opt out? They could end up with a default judgment DR, which, you know, is not going to work out very well. So I think this is something we have to think about. However, I will say I was at the hospital and I saw something that made me think we could do something like this. So I don't know if you've seen this in your neck of the woods, but they have like these programs now where individuals, regardless of the language, like any language, honestly, very, very broad languages, and they have different devices where you can go around. And when you're seeing a doctor, for example, it helps to translate everything that the doctor is saying. So it makes it so that you feel comfortable going to see a doctor, regardless of the dialect, regardless of, you know, and it's very sophisticated. And I watched this and I thought, that's really cool. It was quite impressive in the way it worked. I had never seen anything like that because, I mean, it could be Somali, it could be from this tribal language, it could be all, like they had this really, and I asked someone at the hospital and I said, wow, that's really great. I love that. You know, and I think that there's movement in that direction. I think that we, and especially whatever we have now is sort of nothing in comparison with what we might have 5 years from now. But I do think there's movement in that direction to get better. I mean, I think that's part of, you know, innovation is being able to innovate in ways that are more, because I do think you have to take accessibility for disabilities, for language, for everything. You need to take that into account. And we absolutely could do better as a society on those points.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder too how much of that will in due course spill over into the real-time courts, in terms of inclusiveness, because what you're talking about is using the technology to enhance access, and at the same time asking ourselves in what ways can the technology be improved to enhance inclusiveness. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to be saying to the courts, well, hello, what we're doing over here is, over here we have three official languages in New Zealand. Well, actually only two official languages, the Te Reo Māori, the indigenous language, and New Zealand Sign Language. They have statutory force. English simply happens to have the force of habit. So people can use Māori in any official context. But of course we have a dozen or so Pacific Island languages. We've got a very large refugee and migrant population. So in a way, what occurs to me is what you're doing, what you're suggesting, will also lead the courts in the direction of that kind of inclusiveness.
I love that. I mean, think about it. It is exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the hospitals are doing it, why aren't the courts, right? Like, I mean, there's just, I think that, yeah, that's a great point. I like that.
Is it possible? I mean, I've seen an advertisement somewhere for something with people talking in a restaurant and they've got their mobile phones between them and neither of them speaks the language of the other or of the language of the restaurant. But mm-hmm. they chat it into their phones, which then gives them a voiced translations. But you think here maybe in 5 to 10 years there'll be an invisible stage. It's something you won't have to have your phone. You'll just speak in court and maybe through headphones or whatever that will your language will be translated. Some well-known translation systems, the names of which shall not be mentioned for advertising purposes, do often get things wrong. Mm-hmm. There's some very, very strange translations. I mean, sometimes if I see a translation into one of the languages, other languages I speak, and then I'll do a translation back, I think, I didn't say anything like that. What you're suggesting also is that the technology is developing very rapidly and driven by an ethical ideal, which is something that I discussed with Leah a month or so ago, but driven by it's a moral imperative to enhance access to our resolution system. So that's the driver, isn't it? That moral imperative. And what we're looking at is the technology. So this is rich stuff, Amy. So obviously what I and others are going to have to do is go to that Columbia Journal. The article is out. Oops, I've lost your voice here.
Yes, it came out last. Yeah, it came out in early 2022 or late 20. No, early 2022, I think January or something like that. But it is also on my SSRN page with my signature. But you can also just Google it and find it on SSRN for free. It's freely available.
Okay, so what we'll do also. In the previous conversations, where there is a web link which might be of interest for people to follow, that goes up on the kind of head note of the podcast. So actually, if you could send me the link to that, I'll pass that on to Colin. Because that's a link I know that I would want to follow and others who listen to this, because we're actually getting quite good coverage for these podcasts. So if you could click that link to me, that would be superb, because this is rich stuff. There's a couple of other things, though, in your earlier listing of your research interests, and I'm going to have to come back to you. I just know this. I'm going to do a circuit around all the ODR colleagues and then come back again. In the third of our podcasts, I talked with Colin about the metaverse, and a lot of it was well over my head and a lot of it was absolutely terrifying in terms of the headsets, but you are doing some work on metaverse ODR. Can you say more about that?
So this came up because of students. I love students. They always get me thinking. And of course, and especially my students are really into gaming. So I don't know, are you aware of like the whole gaming thing and yeah. Twitch and people are really into video games, which I'm actually not. Like I never was that person. I just never got into it. But it really got me thinking, wait a minute, there's all this world happening in the metaverse. There's a couple of things to think about. Number one, disputes are going to arise in the metaverse, about the metaverse, people who use the metaverse. Mm-hmm. Yep. What we know about people is they like to resolve disputes in that same, if they're comfortable with that space, if they're comfortable with sort of the anonymity of the metaverse, they're comfortable operating through an avatar, there might be a lot of reasons why that's where they feel more comfortable. It might make sense that that is a place for them to resolve the disputes in the metaverse. And the thought is you could have metaverse mediation or arbitration, absolutely good for the environment. Again, you're not traveling. And perhaps for some individuals, safer than if you were, for example, on Zoom, right? Because you don't want anyone looking at you. And you don't want text-based either, because you do want more expression that's available on the metaverse. And it may be that you like sort of operating through an avatar and it makes you feel empowered. You know, it doesn't matter what color you are, how tall you are, what your size is, what gender you are, you're just an avatar, right? And so that might be more comfortable for you. And if your dispute actually arose on the metaverse, especially, it might make sense that that's a space for you. And some of this actually relates back to Second Life. Do you remember Second Life?
Yes. It's still around. It's still there, isn't it?
Is it still around? I don't know.
I haven't checked in several years, but I don't know. But yeah, they had a compulsory arbitration system.
They did. They had a compulsory arbitration. And I remember back then I was teaching secure transactions and we were talking about, well, could you take a security interest? Could collateral be in the metaverse? And then it got me thinking, well, if you did have a fight about the collateral, where should you have it resolved? Maybe not in mandatory in-person arbitration. Maybe it should actually be in the Second Life. And it's kind of similar ideas there. But I could see, you know, I don't think it's right for every kind of dispute by any means, but I think it's a possibility, especially considering the different types of problems. You know, as Ethan has so famously said and correctly said, technology creates new disputes that we never imagined. And we have a lot of new disputes regarding things in the metaverse, assault, theft. There's a lot of different issues that come up in the metaverse, and it might make sense to have those disputes also resolved in the metaverse. So, and it raises some kind of interesting thought questions about what might be available. And you know, I think also if you are somebody, let's say, again, it just depends on what you value, what you need out of the process, what makes sense for you and what you feel comfortable with to solve that problem. And so I think we, again, being creative, there's a lot of places we can go with that.
The metaverse for you, I mean, we got a definition from Colin a month or so ago. How do you see the metaverse being used? I mean, I think your point is absolutely right, is that, you know, areas like Second Life, I mean, one of the things that used to just make my hair curl or ears, just wondering about what it is that invites people to buy stuff that doesn't exist.
I know. Well, look at NFTs.
Well, exactly. Yeah, or cybercurrency. You know, buying stuff that doesn't exist with money, what they paid good money to buy, the, in Second Life's case, the Linden currency. And then disputes arise because people are stealing their intellectual property. And oh, God, this makes my head hurt. But yeah. I think your point is, if people, and particularly those who operate in the gaming universe, spend time in that world, and I guess with some of the large online platforms, the meta world, I'm not using that in a corporate name, but that world is going to grow. You know, where do you see the metaverse being used in the next few years, and particularly in the world that you occupy in law? I mean, do you see a meta law world at all?
There could be. I mean, look at Second Life. There were law firms that set up shop, and
and New York Times, Washington Post, Guardian,
Nike. Yeah. No, I think the truth is, it remains to be seen. There's also the fact that people like to be the first, right? So I would not be surprised if some big law firm said, you know what, we're going to set up shop in the metaverse and we're going to handle all these big issues with gaming. I do think the reason I go to the gaming issue is I think there's a lot of money there, and wherever there's money, there's disputes, and it matters. And
that's
people
so cynical, Amy.
I know, right?
How could you
I'm the
say
first
that?
Person to ever say that too.
I don't know. Think I'll make
ever.
A note of that. Amy said it.
Amy said money, but it's true. You know, wherever there's money, there's disputes. Oh, how sad, but true. Mm. Yeah, no, but you know what? It really is. It was interesting. As soon as I raised that issue in class, I mean, students brought up all sorts of examples, and like I said, I mean, there's followings. You know, people who are really like with Twitch and with this online real-time gaming, and now it's like an esport and esports, you know, I could see that area being maybe the first adopters.
I think of the world occupied by my little 10-year-old grandson, who is doing very simple coding and lives in that world. And when he talks to us, he basically is on a broadcast mode, because it's not a conversation. It's just talking about the stuff that's going on in this very, very intelligent little brain. But he lives, I guess, as his 12-year-old sisters, they live in the world of gaming, of constructing. I can't remember the name of the one where you construct universes, construct versions, but folks live there.
I know, it worries me.
I guess I don't really understand it, which is why I'm looking forward to a walk around the harbour in due course, just to sort of disconnect. And in a way, you know, what you're telling us is that the world that we already have and are seeing emerge, which is the world of online transactions, the world of online communication, particularly in our pandemic and not yet post-pandemic world, where people are obliged to communicate this way, transactions are done this way. We need tools to manage it. You can't simply hop on your horse and ride down to the local sheriff's office. And what we're facing, this is where we came in, we're facing a vast swathe of people who do not have access to the resolution at the point at which they arise. Whether that's they've bought themselves a $15 book online, or an item of clothing, or they've bought an NFT. and suddenly it's not worth an awful lot. Our world of legal solutions isn't fit for purpose.
And
what we're looking at is creating something that is fit for purpose.
Yeah, and I think it's just the reimagining. You know, we really have to sort of reimagine and be creative in the way that we do that, I think is absolutely essential.
Can I circle around to because I'm just aware of my time and yours, because you're still at work.
And mine, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of finish with a question, which is your book that you co-authored with Colin Rule on the new handshake, because this kind of, I think for me, may wrap up what you're talking about. As I recall reading it, and it's about the technologies, but also it's about how we implement trust. And how we find ways. I mean, one of the terms I think you used in that book, and I reacted not terribly well to it, is finding trust mechanisms. And trust mechanisms sounds not terribly human. What for you is the new handshake? And for people who haven't read the book, and for heaven's sake, go and read the book, people.
Yes, read the book.
And more likely, buy the book. what did you have in mind with the new handshake?
Yeah, I think what we were trying to do is we were absolutely thinking about consumers at that point in e-commerce, especially, and how do you sort of build that trust, the trust where you want to make a purchase, the trust that used to exist. You know, the whole idea, in fact, came up because I was saying, you know, growing up in a rural area, you know, you go and you buy corn from the farmer, and you literally ride your bike. I kid you not, I would ride my bike with my little basket and I'd ride it down to the farmer. I'd buy corn from the farmer. And if I got home and I shucked the corn and it's got worms, I could just go back And the farmer would give me new corn because I trusted that farmer. I went and bought corn from him. We looked at each other. He'd shake my hand. I gave him his money. And that shaking that hand was like a trust mechanism, right? Yeah. It was, this is real. I know you're good for it. And then we were thinking about in the online world, how you don't have that same sort of look you in the eye, shake your hand experience. Mm-hmm. And how do you build trust? And what we really were thinking about is enforcement mechanisms for getting a remedy if something goes wrong. And so that is really the idea behind the new handshake. And then coming up with different ways that you might be able to do that short of going to court. And that is the challenge, coming up with ideas. We came up with an idea for a trust mark, essentially, that yeah. would be built into the different merchants into their website. And they would want to have it because it would make consumers comfortable purchasing from that merchant, which would be a win-win because they could make money. We also, of course, built trust in the book. We argue and put forth an idea. And again, these are all just ideas, but like where you would actually have like an escrow system. So the merchants who were able to use the system and had the benefit of using the system, avoiding lawsuits and avoiding all the cost and the bad press that of course happens with lawsuits, yep. They would get that benefit only if they would put funds into the escrow account, which would be sort of a backup if a merchant didn't pay. So then consumers had some mechanism for getting a remedy without having to go to court. And that's the idea of providing trust mechanisms, because if you know that you've got recourse, that builds trust. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about that secure transactions is a perfect example. I taught secure transactions for many, many years. And the whole idea is building trust. It is all about trust mechanisms. That's what collateral is, right? If you buy something and it's secured, if that purchase is secured by the collateral, that builds trust. Why do you think banks lend people money? They don't just trust you out of hand, not just because they think you look like you're a nice person. They want collateral. It's building trust.
And they've so got hands on the keys to my house.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all about having these trust mechanisms built into a process that helps it be successful.
In the online world, it goes back to things we talked about earlier. One of the challenges to trust is to know that the person you think you're talking to, in fact, is the person you're talking to. You could hop on your bicycle and go down and talk to the farmer, and you knew that that farmer was there. We can't always be confident of that, can we?
No. And that, I think, is the problem with the metaverse. It's the problem with a lot of these different, I actually had a situation recently, where I thought somebody was an actual electrician. They created an entirely fake persona, a fake license, a fake everything. And it looked so real. And the guy did work on my house and I had no idea that he was not at all. It was all a facade. And that's in the real world. Mm-hmm. So in the online world, imagine how vast that could get, right? And so that idea, even when I was talking about the metaverse piece, the reason I was saying gaming is it would have to be with people who already trust the metaverse. It couldn't be with others. Sure. I think that's the other piece is how do you know anyone is real? How do we make sure that we have that sort of, fraud is hard. That one's hard to fight.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we're going to have fraud in the real world and the human world. So there's no reason to imagine we're not going to have fraud in the other world. Yeah,
exactly.
But that's we shouldn't end on too negative.
No,
But I mean, what's exciting about what you're doing, Amy, is you're taking the key elements. Is one of the things we haven't talked about, and we haven't now got time. Is ethical AI? But it seems to me that the thread that's running through this is you're taking some of the core principles that have run our respective legal systems, and saying how do we take those principles, hold on to them, and translate them into a world which is now increasingly online, digital, where services are online, where people require access to services, et cetera, and therefore we need to be able to build trust around those.
I think it's important. There are definitely pitfalls. I've been talking and doing research more recently, really on the ethical AI piece. And, there's definitely pitfalls, but if we can harness the promise, we could do a lot of good. And so that, I think, is reason to keep soldiering on.
That sounds like a point at which you should close, and I should allow you to go home. Amy, it's just such a treat to catch up with you again, and thank you so much for giving us this time. And I know you're coming to the end of a long day where you are in Columbus, and I'm just starting the day here, so I'll allow you to go home. Thank you so much for your time. And
thank you. Thank you. Absolutely. Yeah, please. And, you know, thank you. It's just such a delight to see friends and to get a chance to chat about things I care about, like technology and access to justice. So thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.